You're listening to the Infinite Loopback Podcast, an Apple-themed technology podcast hosted by Brian Baggett, Jim Graham, and Brad Tarver. Well, it's another Saturday morning. It's an unseasonably cold morning in the South, no matter where in the South you are, apparently. It was 27 here in Atlanta this morning. Jim was saying it was in the 40s in Dallas. What about you, Brad?
About 45 degrees.
Well, another week has come and gone. Before we jump into things, I wanted to see, so have you guys seen any good movies or TV shows you binge lately? Anything you recommend?
I just started watching that new F. Scott Fitzgerald show, Z, The Beginning of Everything. It's been pretty good. I think I'm on episode 5. The episodes go really fast because they're only 30 minutes. I've always been a fan of Christina Ricci, even from when she was, you know, Wednesday Addams. So she's really good on it.
Yeah, I'd heard about that. What about you, Jim?
The best thing I've watched lately is still The Crown. So I finished the OA this week. I still don't know what to think. It just, that was weird. God, that was weird. People were comparing it to Stranger Things, and I don't know. Stranger Things, even though it's obviously science fiction, it was more kind of just your mainstream monster, you know, parallel universe science fiction. The OA was just weird. And it's almost like they took Stranger Things and they mixed it with Black Mirror from the BBC and then made a, 10-hour show. I'm going to have to take some time to digest it because it just, I don't know if I liked it or not.
Interesting. I got to give that a look. I've heard people, they're usually pretty divided on it. They either really liked it or they really hated it. Then again, I thought Stranger Things was it was good, but it was way overhyped for what it ended up being, my opinion. I am going to have to give The Crown a shot too. You've talked about it. I've heard other people say it's really great. And that show that just dropped on Netflix yesterday, that Santa Clarita Diet with Timothy Oliphant and Drew Barrymore, looks really, really good. I am going to recommend something that I don't know if you guys have watched it or not, but it's entirely on Netflix right now, or the second season's about to be. It's Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. Have you guys watched that show?
I haven't. Is it a scripted show or a reality show?
Never heard of it.
It is a scripted show. It's on the CW, and it's a really, I can't believe something this clever is on television. It's one of those things where there's no way this would make it on a big network thing, so it's on the CW is where it is. That deal that they struck with Netflix, 11 days after a season ends, the entire season gets dumped on Netflix. So it had its second season finale last night, so by Valentine's Day, it'll be on, the entire second season will be on there. You guys really need to watch this show. I mean, it is completely bingeable. It's about this woman who is a Harvard-educated lawyer in New York, and within the first 5 minutes of the show, she decides on a whim to move across country to stalk this guy that she went to camp with. And it's a comedy, and it has this music, at least one musical number every episode. The songs are all really clever and really well done. And it's not like they break into song every 5 seconds. It's one number a show, usually. But they are really, really clever, really well done. I guarantee you start watching this, you'll finish it. Actually, it's pretty quick. I think there's only there's maybe 18 episodes the first season, and there's only 13 or something the second. But very, very good show.
I definitely won't mind one song a show. I never was a fan of Glee. There would be three or four songs a show, and that there were always songs that I already knew. They were just sort of retreaded for the show so that a choir could perform it instead of, a rock band. So anyway.
I usually hated that crap. So it sounds like it's in the vein of a Matt and Trey kind of song, not necessarily something serious. So
yeah, they're not serious songs. They're not, they're all germane to the plot, and they're all, the thing that strikes me as weird is how well done they are. And they're different genres. They do different styles. And it's all, I mean, speaking of things, I'll let it out. One of them was about a relationship that went bad. It was called, the song is called This Is a Show. And they allow it on TV and they bleep out the things. But I guarantee if you watch it, you won't skip the musical parts. They're actually really, really good. Kind of like a Hamilton type thing where it's even if you're not familiar with that, I can listen to that soundtrack all day long. It's nuts.
So do they bleep it on Netflix too?
I don't know if they bleep it on Netflix. That one happened in the second season, and I won't know for another week or two until it drops on Netflix, but it's pretty funny.
I've been rehashing old, early Weird Al Yankovic this past week, so maybe it's my ramp up to this new ex-girlfriend show.
From the Dr. Demento days?
Yes.
I'm also going to start Sneaky Pete because Bryan Cranston's on it. Who doesn't like him? He's a bad guy on this one, so.
I haven't picked out my next show. I just finished the OA on Thursday night, so I need to pick out something else to start this weekend. Maybe the ex-girlfriend will be it.
If you don't like the pilot, I'll be shocked. If you can't make it past that, I'll be very surprised.
I did start watching It's Always Sunny. It's kind of my, I'm doing stuff around the apartment, turn on a show to have on in the background. And that show, I mean, I don't think they could air that if it started now, because there is so much that is completely politically incorrect in that show. I don't think they could do it if it started now.
That's one reason why it comes on at 10 or 11 o'clock on FX.
Yeah, it's especially that first season when you go back and you watch some of those things, but it's insane the stuff they get away with. This past week, they did a parody of Making a Murderer, which was which was pretty good. I can't believe it's in its 12th season.
I can't either, because I can clearly remember when it started. I just never got into it back then. I'm on season 3 or 4 now. I don't know. They go pretty quick, you know, when you're just watching them on Netflix.
I like the first season that didn't have Danny DeVito in it, because it felt like a little bit of a different show. And then when they got him, it kind of changed a little bit. But it's still really, really good. They went to a water park a couple of weeks ago, and it turned into like a heist movie almost, and something they did. They're still firing on all cylinders, I think. It's still really good.
It's definitely an irreverent show, but I do literally laugh out loud every week.
I just went through a couple of the episodes where we're sorting out whose dad is who, so that's kind of interesting.
Everything on FX and FXX is pretty good. I watched that and Baskets, which is definitely a strange, strange show with Zach Galifianakis. And Man Seeking Woman is probably, again, one of the best shows you've probably never seen. If you go back on Hulu right now, the first two seasons are there. Each one's half an hour. Watch that show. You will dig it. Very absurdist, very surreal. It's strange. All right, let's jump into the news. So, of course, Apple released their financials this week for the last quarter, and wow, they're back, man. They bounced back. They sold more iPhones in this quarter than any other quarter in their history. So it was, I think, 78.2 million phones. The iPad sales are down from 16.1 million a year ago to 13.1 million now. The Mac is kind of flat, which, 5.3 to 5.4. Given the problems even you guys have seen with the MacBook Pros, that's not really surprising. And their services increased from 6.1 billion to 7.2. So I'm guessing a lot of that was probably Apple Music picking up a few more million subscribers and things like that. But I'm guessing no one really cared about getting rid of the headphone jack. So what do you guys think about that?
I was going to anecdotally say that maybe the headphone jack drove the higher sales of iPhones, which that's probably not true. I can't see somebody spending $800 or so on a phone and deciding that I really need this phone because of the wireless headphones. But there are those people that just want to go whole hog, and they think one little thing is the coolest thing and they have to have that new thing.
I think the Galaxy Note scared a lot of people away from Samsung, period. I think that's one of the biggest contributors here. It's not that people wanted a Note and went and bought iPhones. It's that they heard in general that Samsung phones are exploding. They didn't relate it to any particular phone.
A specific model.
Right. I mean, because when you talk about the iPhone, most people just think of it as the iPhone, you know, whereas with Samsung, they do have a bunch of different devices. But I think that was a key contributor. And I guess you have to go back and look at the upgrade cycles. I think the non-S cycle is usually the bigger of the two, just based on historical upgrades. Now, we'll see if that changes, because people aren't doing two-year agreements anymore like they always were. It was always an every two-year thing. Now that's all up in the air, because some people are doing, you know, 1 year, some people are doing 18 months or 20 months or 24. You know, I mean, it's there's a big mix of all of that. So as far as the Macs go, it's hard to really pin any of it, I think, on the new MacBook Pro, because that model wasn't released until early November. The first people didn't get them in their hands until right at Thanksgiving, and they still weren't shipping soon until after the new year. So there was still a backlog of them by, you know, at Christmas time. So they couldn't have shipped a whole lot of the new MacBook Pros last year, but there could have been a drop in sales because a lot of people like me were waiting all year for this. Like I was ready to upgrade in, you know, April or May, but I waited all the way till Thanksgiving to buy one because I knew the new one would eventually be coming out.
And that's part of the reason why you have such hurt feelings over sort of a broken new MacBook, just because you forced yourself to wait so long.
Exactly.
I think the sales are probably better than you would expect, because not everybody customizes their MacBooks too. So a lot of places you can go in and just buy an off-the-shelf MacBook Pro, and it's good enough for a lot of people. We're kind of outliers because we tend to do that, but I don't think the majority of people actually probably take the time to do that. And the other thing to remember with the phones too is, in the last 2 years, carriers, all of the carriers plus Apple, have the leasing programs. So if you sign up for those, you're paying a monthly fee. I'm pretty sure those are counted as new sales, and you just pay that flat fee and you get the new phone every year. You know, I think that's probably going to do wonders to sort of buoy those numbers.
Yeah, ink on the paper is a sale.
Yep.
You know, I didn't think about that, but that's true, because before it was always a 2-year cycle because that's just what the carriers did. But now that the carriers and Apple are doing this 12-month deal, that should lead to more people upgrading every year. So, yeah, you're right.
And we'll see if that bears it out, because they had it, I think, as far back as, 2015. But I guess now it's really the people that were on contracts from 2014 have finally rolled off. I think that was the last year that most of the carriers were doing contracts. So we'll see how it goes going forward. So let's talk about the iPad. Those iPad numbers down 3 million. This is something that really doesn't make a lot of sense. And I was reading on Ben Brooks's website. He has a great write-up on the sales numbers. And sort of the takeaways that he had were that many folks just end up relying on their phones now that phones have gotten larger. Apple doesn't market the iPad well at all, which I would agree. They don't really do that. And they don't dispel the notion that it's not a real computer. So why do you guys think iPad sales are slumping?
I honestly think it's, like you said, the larger screen sizes that are available on the iPhones, especially the plus size, just because it's damn near close to the iPad mini in both pixels and actual inches of resolution.
I think there's a lot of factors at play here. One of the top ones is exactly what Brad said, that the phone, is, especially the Plus, is so close to the size of the smallest iPad. I think number two is iPads tend to last a long time. And if you've got one, people upgrade their phones. You use your phone, you beat up your phone. You used to get a new phone every 2 years. Now, what we just mentioned is, hey, you might be getting a phone every year. People buy an iPad and they use it until it dies, or they drop it and it's cracked, and then they might go get another iPad. It's not a gotta have device like a phone. It's more of a luxury device to most people. And so it's just not something that it's on an upgrade cycle, and it doesn't get junked up like a Windows PC or all that with a bunch of spam. It doesn't slow down necessarily. If you still got an iPad 2 out there, it's a brick and it's slow. And I think also the proliferation of really cheap Android tablets that aren't as bad as they once were. I mean, when the Android tablets first started dropping, they were awful. I mean, just think about the first Amazon Fires or that thing. I just remember the reviews is it was always click and wait, and they were so slow and they didn't do anything. I mean, those devices, they're still not iPads, but for what most people need, they work, especially for kids. And if you're buying a cheap device for kids, iPads have not come down in price. Correct me if I'm wrong at all. Like a bottom of the line, regular old iPad is still $499. Like that, they still have that. Now you can get a mini for a little bit cheaper, but just the standard size iPad is $499.
If you're buying them for a kid, though, you're probably going to, if you were going to get an iPad for a child, you would get a mini, though. You probably wouldn't get a full-sized iPad, smaller hands, I mean.
That's true. I mean, well, even the mini, though, is $399. I mean, they don't sell them without the Retina on them anymore, I don't think.
I think you can still get the iPad mini 2. I think I saw one. I was just browsing the other day, and they're still available.
Well, okay. I just think people they're not spending as much, and those Android devices, while they're still not iPads, they're better than they used to be, and they work for what people want them, which is, you know, playing the equivalent of what used to be Flash type games that aren't, you know, just app games now, and watching movies, you know, TV and movies on Netflix and such, so.
When it was relevant, people would play Plants vs. Zombies on their phone, and then they got an iPad, and that was the first game they wanted to put on their iPad. What made me really notice that my iPad was getting slow was when I upgraded my phone, because whenever I got my iPad, I remember Jim and I both won a free iPad at the same time, and it was, I guess, the iPad 2. It had just come out, and there was some promotional thing that we had both signed up for, and somehow we both won one. Anyway, I had the contemporary phone that matched the same release date around that iPad, but then as I upgraded, I've really noticed like something's wrong with my iPad, and you could blow it away. And I think part of what made it feel slow was either updated iOS releases with, you know, additional code in them, and also the distinct difference in performance between the CPU in the phone and the iPad, being able to use them side by side, and you could literally see page refreshes in Safari be 3 times faster than they were on the iPad.
Just so you know, the iPad Mini 2 I just checked is still available on Apple's store on their site for $269, starting at $269. So you can get a low-cost mini iPad, not as low as some of the comparable Android tablets, but the Android tablets still don't have a plethora of native tablet-sized apps. A lot of those that you use feel like blown-up phone apps. And I say that as someone who just bought a $200 Android tablet for something. We'll talk about that next week. It's still not a great experience over in Android land. I still think the experience on the whole as a tablet experience is still better on the iPad. But that being said, you touched on something that was very important there, Jim. Most people, historically, what you would see is they would buy a computer, they would keep it for years, and what would cause them to get a new one? Well, their Windows installation would get gunked up. It would become slower. It would become unusable. And the next thing you know, it's, well, I got to get rid of this computer. This one's a piece of junk, even though it's really, you could probably spend an hour or so and get it back to a usable state. A lot of people would get rid of their computers because of that sort of Windows rot that would happen inevitably. But with iPads, if you're an average person and all you do is hit Facebook and maybe Twitter and the occasional web page or occasional YouTube video, an iPad is just fine. And they don't typically tend to get gunked up. And if you're like most people, you don't necessarily upgrade the OS every time an OS update comes out. It can run that way for a long, long time without any issue. I tend to think that was something that you touched on that's actually probably pretty accurate. Once you get past the iPad Air, once you get into that era of computing, those things are still pretty snappy and pretty fast. Though I would have to agree with Ben Brooks and probably Federico if I had to guess. I love using my iPad Pro. I mean, if I'm not doing something that requires an iPad like podcasting or, you know, putting stuff in Plex and transcoding things, that's kind of my go-to device. I can take it anywhere. I can type on it for long form. I can just play on it. I can draw on it. It's a fun device. A lot more, you know, fun in quotation marks than probably than the Mac is. Has that been your experience as well? Especially with the MacBook that you have.
I had a meeting yesterday morning. Walked into the meeting with my iPad Pro because that's usually what I'll bring to take notes on. I had two people on my own team. I say, hey, well, what is that? I'm like, it's, you know, it's the iPad Pro, you know, and they're like, oh, wow, you know, that's big. It still shocks me that people don't know that this thing exists, you know, and they started asking, well, you know, why would you get that one over the other one? And, you know, I'm explaining and, you know, I'm showing them the keyboard. They're like, oh, does it come with the keyboard? I'm like, no, that's another $150 or whatever it is. And then this, you know, this case is another $70-$80, whatever that was, that the backing case. And I'm like, you know, it's not a cheap device, but it's very powerful. I showed them how you could split screen, you know, and actually work, you know, quote, work on there. And they were pretty shocked.
The speakers are so good, you don't need an external Bluetooth speaker.
That lends a lot of credence to the fact that Apple really doesn't market it or promote it. Like, you don't really see a lot of commercials for it. They don't talk about it as much. I see more Mac promotion and more iPhone promotion than I ever see with iPad promotion. It's a shame. But I can tell you, my parents, the computer that they're on mostly is their iPads. I each have an iPad, and it feels like they are always on it.
I agree. Same with my parents. They use an iPad, and their computer is completely secondary.
So let's talk about the Apple Watch. I had a buddy of mine that I was hanging out with last week, and he's like, you know, that Apple Watch, I guess that's their dud, huh? And I'm like, what are you talking about? Oh, you know, it's a failure. And I'm just like, it's like, you did know that they've sold, is they're number two behind Rolex in terms of watch sales, right? Okay, whatever. You know, it's like, all right, it's if you believe it's a disappointment. So there was a great article that Rene Ritchie wrote over on iMore saying that it was time to admit the Apple Watch is a success. And he had a link to a tweet where it said that Apple has sold three times as many watches as Amazon has sold Echoes, yet the watch is a disappointment and the Echo is a success. And that's mind-blowing to me. You know, Pebble is dead. Fitbit is limping along. They just had layoffs and restructuring. 2016 saw Motorola leave the smartwatch market, and Android Wear 2.0 was supposed to be out last fall. It got delayed. Do you guys believe the Apple Watch is in trouble? Why or why not?
I don't think it's in trouble at all. I mean, it's supplanting every wearable computer device out there as far as the Fitbits of the world. I never see anyone talk about buying, I need a new Fitbit or I need to go get a Fitbit. You never hear that anymore. You just see somebody show up in the office or wherever you are and they have a new Apple Watch and they'll tell you, oh, I looked at the Fitbit, and they always wind up with the Apple Watch.
The market is just not as big as phones or iPads or whatever. I mean, you just, when you consider what they thought the market was, I don't really think Apple thought they were going to create a new market for an Apple Watch. I think they were trying to fit into an existing market of watches and hopefully hoping that people who would want these kind of devices would pay the premium for an Apple device, which I think they're doing. That article where you're talking about with the watches selling more than the Echo, that shocked me. I can't count on both hands how many podcasts I listened to after Christmas where, and it was Christmas into CES, where everything's got the Echo. Everything's about the Echo. Everybody wanted an Echo this Christmas and they couldn't sell them, you know, couldn't keep them in stores fast enough. Well, that should tell you something right there, that Amazon's production can't keep enough Echoes in stock. Like right now, the Echo is still back ordered like 3 weeks, or the Dot is, because I actually looked this week. Yet Apple is selling more of these watches, and somehow it's a disappointment. I mean, it's just the looking glass of Apple versus Amazon. I mean, when you talk about like profit margins, like how many quarters back of Amazon does it take to make as much profit as Apple did in this one quarter? I bet it's a couple, more than a couple. I mean, I'm just saying, it just that number really shocks me, because the Echo was everywhere on everybody's, the tip of their tongue. They were just talking about it. And the watch just kind of just rolling along.
I'm going to disagree with you on them thinking they were going to create a new market or whatever it is that you said in that vein of things. I feel like Apple sort of released the Apple Watch kind of like they did in 2001 with the iPod, and they were trying to sort of revolutionize on their own the MP3 player market, because you remember how fragmented it was. I mean, it was garbage, and they actually brought real storage size, even though it was a mechanical hard drive, they brought real storage size to these things. I feel like they were trying to do the same thing with the Apple Watch. They kind of saw this non-mainstream market, and they think that they can do something with it. And man, they ran with it. They did that with the iPod, and now they've done it with the Apple Watch. I think it's really awesome the way they do that.
I think they don't know sometimes what a market is going to be. Like, you look back at the iPhone, and you know, originally it was envisioned with no app store. Oh, they're going to write HTML web apps and run on it. And you know, if they had stuck with that philosophy, it would have not taken off. It was at the app store that really made the iPhone.
iOS would be garbage if everything was a HTML wrapped, you know, app. That would be awful.
It would basically be WebOS. So the same thing can be said, I think, with the watch, because you know, they marketed it as you can do this and you can do that. Well, at least the first iteration, you couldn't launch apps. They were so slow as to be unusable. And they had to kind of backpedal and like, what are people using this for? Well, it's a great fitness device. It's a wonderful for notifications and those types of things. So they sort of pivoted a little bit. I think by the time that they can actually sell a model that's not dependent on the watch, not dependent on the iPhone, it'll really take off. Once they can do that, I think it's going to get more traction. You know, the first iteration really felt like a beta product.
You'll just see the other smartwatches drop off the market.
Well, you kind of have already, right, with Motorola leaving the market. I thought the article that I linked to said that LG left the market, but that's not quite the case. I did a little more research on my own, and it looks like they have some models that are supposed to ship this year, but it's still Apple is really unopposed in this market. No one else is selling to the numbers that they are. No one else can claim that they're number two behind Rolex, and those sales figures don't get disputed.
You'll see all the Android-driven watches like on the seasonal aisle at Walgreens or your local Kroger or on the clearance aisle, and then the Apple watches will still be at their regular price point.
Yeah, I think so too. And I think another way to think of it is a smartphone versus a dumb phone. Like, why would I buy a Fitbit that can do one thing or just a couple of things when I could get this device that with each OS update can do something different, right? I can board a plane. I can pay for my prescription. It's my badge into the gym. I pay for my Starbucks with it. I do all of these things with my watch on a regular basis that I couldn't do with any other device.
Let me stop you right there. I could pay for Starbucks with my Pebble. That's the one cool thing I could really do with it.
And if they were still in business, you still could.
Every time I walk into an Apple store, that's the one thing that pulls me, that there's nothing else I need. But anytime I'm in the mall and if I do walk in the Apple store, the one thing that's like magnet that's pulling me over is, you know, you still don't have Apple Watch 2. You can still go ahead and get your stainless version and get your new watch. And I kind of walk over there and I'm like, it's going to be $600-$700. Do you really want to do this? And then I talk myself out of the store. But eventually, I'm not going to talk myself out of the store.
What else doesn't help is that you and I are both sort of watch aficionados. And before the Apple Watch ever came along, or the Pebble, I mean, I was always buying the biggest faced $250, $300 watch I could find, like the Suunto or this really nice blue Nixon I have. I mean, and it was really about, I mean, I wanted an awesome watch with a big face, but every time I'd walk into the elevator at work or something, somebody, and I would be like a business professional. I mean, I would be wearing business casual khakis and a polo and brown shoes, and there would be a man in a suit, and he would say, "Man, look at that watch. I really like your watch." I mean, for somebody that I know is driving probably a $100,000 car and he has on a $5,000 suit, maybe not that much, but still, he's definitely dressed better than I am, and he looks, you know, he looks way more professional than I am as far as what he does every day. That's one thing that really is an eye grabber is a watch, and the Apple Watch has become that. You know, you don't see, I mean, you might see some women saying, "Hey, it's a really nice pearl necklace you have," or "I like that new little custom jewelry you have," but you just don't hear that, whereas everybody points at your watch. I mean, I would constantly go places, at the grocery store, on getting into a car, in the, you know, wherever, people notice your giant watch.
That's one of the reasons there's a market for things like Tags or Rolexes and stuff, because for a man, the watch is about the only jewelry that you could wear every day, you know, and have.
And you don't look like a douche.
Right. One of the only things I don't like about having an Apple Watch is, just like you said, I've got three or four other watches in there that I really like that I don't wear anymore because they don't do the things that this one does. If I put one of those on and I go out, I'm always like, well, damn it. I'm missing what my Apple Watch does. So
you feel sort of hindered because it doesn't do all those magical things that the Apple Watch does, except tell the time.
Right. It tells the time. Yeah, it tells the time. It does that very well. It does that better than the Apple Watch, but it doesn't do all the other stuff. Because when I bought my Apple Watch, it was about, I don't know, 6-8 months after they had first came out, and they marked them down at Christmas that year. And so I just bought the aluminum one, the Sport. And once I realized now that I really like it, then now, you know, I figure if I get a new one, I'll invest in a stainless and decide if I want a Darth Vader band or not, as Brian shows his off in the video chat.
Is the stainless one much heftier than the aluminum one as far as, you know, weight on your wrist?
I think so. It's definitely heavier when you feel it. Yeah, I don't know. It seems like something you could get used to, but it's definitely heavier just when you're looking at them in the store.
I mean, I have a giant Swiss Army watch that I just got probably a year and a half ago, and it's stainless, and then I put a woven nylon band on it, but it's still really heavy. Now, don't get me wrong, I love this watch, but it's seriously, it's like a third of an inch thick, and it's probably 45 millimeters. I mean, it's a big watch.
Yeah, so the stainless steel, the Apple Watch, you know, is 42 millimeters. I'm not a watch guy. I wore watches. You know, I was a big nerd in high school. I had the Casio calculator watch and those types of things that I wore probably until I graduated high school, and then I stopped wearing a watch until the Apple Watch came out. And just the notion of getting used to wearing a watch again was very different for me. It took a while until I wasn't paying attention to it constantly.
It's like being a newlywed and you first start wearing that wedding ring and you're constantly thumbing it with your fingers like, man, this thing's really bothering me, or you're spinning it on your finger or something. The watch sort of starts off that way.
Oh, that wedding ring is like a big scarlet letter A, Brad. Everybody else notices that too.
Exactly. It's a foreign thing you're not used to. This is true. But you know, it's now I'm to the point it doesn't feel like anything. It doesn't bother me at all. It doesn't have, you know, a lot of weight. I will say the one thing that I wasn't expecting when I first got the watch was the frequency at which I would change bands. Because when I originally got it, I got the black Darth Vader Steel Link bracelet and the sport band. And now, let's see, right now I have the black woven nylon band, which is what I wear when I'm around the house most of the time. It's just the nylon band. I'll wear that one to work a lot too. If I'm working out, I bought a knockoff Nike band. You know, it's the sport band with the ventilated holes, which I really, really like a lot. I cannot wait for them to sell that thing as a separate item, because I will buy the official Nike one in a heartbeat, because the knockoff one works the same way, but it's getting it in and out of the watch is not quite the same, but it's good enough for now.
Sort of like buying it secondhand at the thrift store. It's kind of beat up. It just doesn't fit quite right.
Well, those, what do you call them? The things that go in the
lugs.
Yes, the lugs. Thank you. The lugs, all one of them always gets stuck. Usually the top one is really tricky to get out. So, generally, it's been my experience with the knockoff bands. People will say, you can buy the cheap ones on Amazon and they're just as good. They're not. Honestly, they are not. From a build quality perspective, I had a knockoff Black Milanese loop before the official Milanese loop, the Black Milanese loop came out. And I thought, this would be good enough. No, it used to catch the hairs on my arm. Same problem of, you know, hard to get in and out. When the official one came out, yeah, it was $200. But my goodness, it works so much better than the others. That's the other thing. If I'm going out and I need something that looks kind of nice, I'll either use the Darth Vader Steel Link or I'll use the Black Milanese loop. And again, I thought, give me two bands and that'll probably be one too many. And I have four or five right now. And that's just about the right amount between what I switch. And I could easily do more.
You could probably easily get away with just two, you know, like one for cash and then one for dressy all the time. You know, at the very minimum, two.
Yes, I think minimum two is probably the right number. But again, I'm not a fussy watch guy. I didn't think that I would even, I thought two would be too much. You know, I've got four or five. And I'm surprised by the fact that I actually like to change the bands and do other things with it. Because I thought, that's not me. That's not who I am. I don't care about that stuff. But you do. The way that it feels, the way that it looks, it really does make a difference. I find myself enjoying switching those out and depending on the situation, what I'm wearing.
I get ready to leave the house and, you know, I've got three or four watches there on my nightstand, not sort of prominently displayed. They're just sort of laid there. And then I have four or five bands curled up in a loop right beside them so that I can just swap them at any time. And I've got a cigar box in my closet that's full of bands that are interchangeable with most of my watches. I like those Meritac woven nylon bands, and they're very similar to your woven nylon Apple band. They're all one piece. It's called the Meritac Zulu. And actually, you can get sort of aftermarket lugs for your Apple Watch and then use a Meritac type band. It probably wouldn't be as clean as it would be if you used the official Apple band.
They sell a Meritac style. I've seen them in Best Buy where it's got the Apple band attachments on the end of that nylon woven. But I mean, I think one of the cool things about the Meritac is when you put your watch on it,
right,
it's like secured onto the band. I mean, it's really there. You could lose one of the clasp and it's still, your watch isn't going anywhere.
I guess with the Zulu band, you know, the one long piece, it wouldn't be very helpful on the Apple Watch since you've got all those sensors on the back side of it. I was going to say, I've always been a watch guy, always. I was never one of those kids that wanted to wear a gold chain in high school or whatever. And I'm not trying to point anybody out saying those kids. I just wasn't one of those people. And
B-Rad.
B-Rad from Malibu. But
you didn't have a gold herringbone necklace, Brad? What?
No, sir. No herringbone. None of the nuggets or whatever. I didn't have the nugget ring like you saw people have in high school or even junior high. I remember getting a class ring in 10th or 11th grade, and I immediately gave it to that current girlfriend. I mean, I didn't even wear it a week.
Your parents loved you for that, anyway. By the way.
I'm sure. I mean, come on. It's a 10-karat gold ring. I mean, what are you going to do with like a aquamarine in it? How expensive was that ring, really? I mean, they probably did charge several hundred dollars, but I guarantee it wasn't worth more than $100. There's probably more tin in it than there was gold. But I do remember my fifth or sixth birthday, I had a Spider-Man cake and I got a Spider-Man watch. Whereas, you know, a lot of kids, this was, you know, 1981, 1982, and the Mickey Mouse watches are still really popular. You know, the gold tone watch with a faux leather band or whatever, and that was really popular then, but I wanted a Spider-Man watch, so that's what I got. And I remember being 8 or 9 years old and, you know, doing crap around the house for my parents, taking out the garbage, whatever, and I saved up enough money to get my first Swatch. And man, when the Swatch came out, I had four or five of them at least within the first year that they hit the market. They're like really saturated the market here in the South anyway. And instead of, you know, putting a new band on your Swatch, man, you just go buy a new Swatch. Of course, you could interchange, the bands were interchangeable, but you just go buy another Swatch, man. You got a whole new wardrobe option there. It, you know, as versatile as 10-year-old wardrobes are.
So let's talk about Apple is reportedly building more of its own chips to use in Macs. So it looks like first we had the Touch Bar that was a custom ARM chip, and now the power consumption feature, aka Power Nap, is due to be controlled by ARM in the future. What do you guys think about this? Is this a sign of things to come, or do we see that the future of the Mac's going to be several ARM chips doing different things until they're ultimately doing everything? What do you think?
I think it's pretty exciting tech. It's sort of like having a a virtual server type machine where you have dual socket machine with 10 cores each on each box, and then you have 20 pieces of different server software running, and you've got a basically a different instance running for every task instead of piling 20 tasks onto one machine and sort of oversubscribing the machine. Anyway, I would like to see it actually, and I just watched a 30-minute press release from 88 maybe, where Steve Jobs introduced the next cube machine. He didn't go into a lot of detail, but it was there in front of tech press, and Ross Perot was at the press conference, but he was talking about all the custom chips, you know, the custom boards and chips that they had made for it. And I know this is Jobs, and Jobs isn't around anymore, but it's sort of akin to that to me, where they're going to try to find a top-down sort of architecture and software paradigm for themselves.
For me, I think it's going to be difficult for them to go for the whole Mac to be running Apple chips, because I think Intel chips are so ubiquitous there now. And I know they made the switch from PowerPC to Intel at some point. I think we're more likely to see the Mac ramping down a little bit, and then maybe more iPad usage or some sort of iPad device that is more of a dual Mac / iPad together that are running just on Apple chips. But for the main processor, I don't know. I don't see them going that far down the rabbit hole on CPUs, but it definitely could be a possibility. I can't see them being as good really fast, and we're already having troubles with our Macs.
I also think about it being sort of like the system on a chip type thing with the watch or the W1 chip in the AirPods, where they've sort of got just one main board and they don't have all the other things plugged into it, like the memory and the storage and all that. It's just one board inside of an aluminum housing. I feel like that would probably cut down on maybe production costs, because I just feel like it would be a new way to make the MacBook more prevalent and relevant in the market, to sort of redesign its architecture.
I think it's going to be kind of cool that you're going to have a real differentiator between Macs and PCs pretty soon. Instead of just being the only differentiator really is the OS and maybe the block of aluminum that it was machined out of, you're actually going to have actual physical differences from an architecture perspective. I also wonder too, if by offloading things to custom subsystems that are powered by ARM chips, they're going to be less dependent on the chip cycle process from Intel, right? You know, a lot of times they end up holding off, hey, we want to put, you know, Skylake or Kaby Lake or whatever in these boxes. And if Intel misses their date, maybe this is a reason that, and of course we'll never know, but maybe this is a reason Apple doesn't release new Macs. So by doing what they're doing, maybe they'll get more bang for their buck from an existing processor line. Or it could just be about increasing efficiency as well too. I mean, PowerNap has been something we've had on, you know, Intel-based Macs for a couple of years now. If this is a thing where maybe they can get significant gains by offloading it to an ARM subsystem, maybe they would truly get those 30-day standby times that they like to tout with everything, you know, if they're having a low-powered subsystem that actually is dedicated to that. I have a feeling that it's going to be trying to make it do more in the same or a slightly smaller form factor is what this is truly being driven by. I would agree with you. I mean, the fastest ARM processor is still slower than the M processor that's in the current generation regular MacBook. So I don't see ARM supplanting that anytime soon. But it's pretty interesting what they're going to probably be able to accomplish by doing this. And I don't think anyone anticipated this type of thing happening, first with the touch bar and now this.
So I just paid, you know what, $3,500 for this MacBook, and there's no way I would have paid that much for it if it didn't have an Intel chip inside it to where I could also run Windows and Parallels, because I use this laptop for work, and for work I have to have a Windows computer whether I like it or not. That's the life of a consultant, is we're all over the place, and Windows is, you know, it's just, it's in the enterprise, so that's what I have.
When they had Windows RT, that was Windows on an ARM chip, and that still wouldn't have helped you either for the most part, because you still couldn't run the Windows apps.
You couldn't run any apps. It was garbage.
There you go. So no, point taken. I don't think they're going to replace the entire architecture. I don't think they're ditching Intel. But by supplanting it with these other subsystems, I just don't think that, hopefully, maybe, if they have a new Mac sitting there that they want to be able to release, maybe they won't have to wait for the next generation of processor to get that benefit out of it if they're offloading their own benefits into the supplemental subsystems is kind of what I'm hoping.
I think when other manufacturers can actually tout their laptops and desktops against Mac now. And I think they can now. I mean, I think Dell can come out and say, look at this laptop, or Lenovo can say, look at this laptop compared to a MacBook. Maybe it's not as pretty, but it's faster. It's a lot faster. The graphics are a whole lot newer. You can put a whole lot more memory on it. I mean, they actually have like firepower now, where I think for a couple of years, there really wasn't a question of whether a MacBook was better than just about any PC laptop you could get, because it really was. I mean, they were using the same chips. They were on the same chip cycle. They were, you know, it was a little bit faster cycle, you know, all those things. And then when they went to the onboard and discrete chips for graphics, I mean, that was really, you know, a big stepping point for MacBooks. But now, I mean, I wouldn't buy one because I like Mac OS also, but I really think that you can look at competing laptops from Dell or Lenovo and say, that is a viable alternative to a MacBook if you're not a Mac person, if you like Windows, or, you know, if more, not so much if you like Windows, but if you're indifferent to the operating system, then I think they're definitely competing products out there now. And for a while there, I don't think there was any competition for Apple.
You know, if you could be software agnostic, sure. You know, for someone like you or me or another sort of power user who knows their apps really well, like you could use Word on any computer or iPad. But when my parents' laptop died last year sometime, I told them, I was like, please get a Mac. You'll be so much more happy with it. And both of my parents are in their early 60s, and they just kind of frowned, and they're like, it's just too different. Like, and they really don't know. I know that they've never stepped foot in an Apple store. I know that they've never really put their hands on my MacBook before. You know, sure, browsing the web is exactly the same, pretty much. You click the mouse or you click the trackpad and you move around on the web. And that's pretty much what my dad uses his Lenovo laptop for. But it's at the same time, it's, you know, I wish I was more of a salesperson and could have really sold him on that, just because it would have been so much better. And I just think Macs are superior in every way. I would never want to push Windows on someone, you know, even if I just couldn't do it. I'm sorry, I'm rambling, but it's Windows is horrible. The Mac Mini is a gateway into a bigger Mac, because you just, I love this Mac, and you see, whoa, I need another one more powerful than this.
I gave my parents my old 2009 iMac, and they'd use Windows exclusively for the entire time they've had a computer. And, you know, there was a period of adjustment, but they made it. My 84-year-old aunt, I got her to ditch Windows finally. And even though it's probably underpowered by our standards, I got her to buy a Mac Mini. And I set it up for her. I put a shortcut to Facebook in the dock. And you know what? It, for what she does, it works. Things like the amount of RAM that are in a system, right? I mean, you see, we've heard the justifications. You see where Apple's coming from. If you have the 32 gigs and it cuts the battery life in half, then that's kind of a thing I could see where they'd be a little hesitant to make as an option if they know it's going to have a worse experience. But also, you're comparing memory usage on a Mac versus memory usage on a Windows machine. So historically, that's been really, really different, right? I always wanted my Windows machine to have 16 or 32 or however much RAM I could stuff into it. But, you know, if I have 16 or 32 on a Mac, am I suffering for the most part? I would say no. I mean, I don't usually get into a situation where Mac OS can't handle whatever I'm throwing at it. But maybe that's just my experience in that one. So our last topic, Super Mario Run. So we've been amped about this game. I really enjoy it. I try not to play it too often because I can sit there and play it for hours, but it made $53 million, had 78 million downloads, but the surprising thing is that only 5% of the customers who downloaded it actually paid the $10 to unlock the entire game. And Nintendo is disappointed, and they wanted a conversion rate that was at least in the double digits, so, you know, crack 10% at least. So, you know, $53 million, nothing to sneeze at. Certainly that's great news for Nintendo. But I kind of share their disappointment. I mean, if people won't pay $10 for Super Mario, then I guess
for a really fun game. It's really fun, especially if you're an old school Nintendo head, like the three of us probably are, at least you and me, Brian, except, you know, for Jim the old man, Mr. Tecmo Bowl.
I played a lot of the original Super Mario Brothers, and I really loved it. I haven't played a lot of this game, but I did pay the $10 because...
Right, right.
You know, I wanted to play more than just, you know, the first levels or whatever. I just have one or two games that I play all the time, and nothing else can can fit in my repertoire.
Well, if people won't pay $10 for Super Mario, then I guess the paid app market truly is as dead as everyone says it is. I was shocked. I honestly thought if there was one bit of intellectual property there, well, okay, I would say there's probably two bits of intellectual property. Anything by Disney and Super Mario. With either of those two characters, you got Mickey Mouse and you got Super Mario, people are going to fork over some cash, I would figure. So I'm really shocked that only 5%, but still 78 million downloads. So 10% would be 7.8. So you still got what? You got like over 3.5 million that did it, like 3.75 or something. That's still nothing to sneeze at in terms of people that would turn around and pay, but still just kind of disappointing, I think.
I wonder if they will actually sell that many of that new console, period, you know? Like the new Nintendo console that they just announced. Will they even sell 3.7 million of those? I bet they don't.
I'd be surprised if they did too, and I don't know that they're going to announce numbers. Most companies don't. The other thing, my friend who dinged me on the Apple Watch, well, they didn't release any numbers. I mean, if it was something to brag about, they'd brag about it. It's like, you know, Amazon doesn't release numbers and never has. Samsung never actually tell you the actual number of units sold, only the ones shipped. So it could be sitting on a shelf. So I'm still kind of bitter about that. But anyway.
20 years from now, we're going to have the whole, you remember the ET controversy where there's like a big hole in the ground somewhere with a bunch of...
cartridges.
ET games. Or cartridges, yeah. Well, 20 years from now, we're going to have the same thing. And they're going to find a huge hole in the ground with a bunch of Samsung phones that shipped but never sold. And be like, ah, now we know.
I think it's going to be out at Yucca Flats where they did the first nuclear test. So when they all explode, you know, they got to be safely away from population so nothing bad happens. But
hopefully all those phones are ROHS compliant so they don't shoot a bunch of mercury and tin into the air.
We should just call this the anti-Samsung hour. We do a lot of fun with them. But yeah, this is really kind of disappointing that...
To be a company as big as that, you have to have some thick skin. I mean, come on. They've got to get it from all sides.
They invite it. They invite the torture. Either that or you've got to have a lot of money so you can pay off people.
So can you guys imagine any other game that would make, you know, $53 million and still be a disappointment? Do you think that Nintendo is right to say, see, we knew this wasn't worth our time? Or do you think this will be the death knell for the paid intellectual property from companies like that?
I kind of liken this game market to the music industry now, where instead of having five or six big players like Madonna and U2 and Bruce Springsteen and Michael Jackson and Prince, you know, just your big artists, it's so wide open now to where anybody can make music and get it out there. And the amount of music we have to listen to nowadays is, what, 100-fold more than you know, say, the 80s or 90s?
It's exponentially, infinitely bigger than it was when we were kids.
When it was, you know, you had to get a CD out and then, you know, you had to hear it on the radio or, you know, you had to buy a CD full of all the songs just to hear them. It's so much easier now. The same way in the game market where it's so much easier for people to develop games and maybe they're, you know, they're not Super Mario Brothers epics, but they're good games that you play for a little while and then you put down and you pick up the next one. There's just so much more out there. It's not that this game for Nintendo wasn't successful. It's just nobody gets that much market share anymore like they used to. It's the same thing where people used to watch, you know, 30%, 40% of people used to watch Seinfeld. If any show got half that now, that the TV industry would love it because there's so much more TV out there that you can consume that no one show gets that huge share. And it's the same thing with these games. You've got to be willing to take your share of the pie, and nobody's share of the pie is as big as it used to be. I mean, it's just I forget the number, but it was from 2 years ago or so when Adele released her new album, and it was something like she made a third of the profits in the music industry for that year. And people were just freaking out that that just doesn't happen anymore. And, you know, she just came out of nowhere and, you know, just selling millions and millions of albums and all the streams. And it's unheard of in general in that industry for that to happen. And I mean, I don't think Nintendo should expect it. I think they got a large share of the market and they will continue getting, you know, a large share, but a large share isn't a third anymore. A large share is 5% or 10% if you're lucky. So I think they have to set expectations a little differently now and spend money developing their games based on those expectations versus getting a third of the market share.
That's probably fair. That should do it for us this week. That's all I have to talk about. You guys have any closing things you want to bring up, or are we good?
I think we're good. It was really good seeing you guys today.
I don't guess we're going to talk about using podcast as a noun or a verb or an adverb today, then, huh? We push that off for the next episode.
Oh, my goodness. I'm going to go full Syracusa when we have to talk about that. That just – the nonsensical – oh, my God.
Everybody out there, subscribe wherever you listen to our podcast, please.
I think I heard somebody on NPR say, subscribe wherever you consume your podcasts.
There you go. Count on NPR to say something that is correct and makes sense. I like that. And hopefully pretty soon you'll be able to tell your Echo to listen to Infinite Loopback.
Please podcast.
And we'll start playing episodes. I'm working on that right now. I hoped to have that done by this morning. That was the thing that I had messaged you guys. Like, hey, I have something cool if it comes in, and it hasn't happened yet. So very shortly, you should be able to get us over your Echo or Echo Dot. So I know I'm feeding into the Amazon ecosystem, but hey, anything that makes it easier to consume our podcast or listen to our podcast, I'm happy to do.
And tell a friend about it. So I posted that on Twitter this week. Tell somebody you know about our podcast, because there's a lot of podcasts out there nowadays, and new, smaller ones are hard to find. So if you've got a friend, a fellow Mac nerd, and you happen to stumble across us, or you've got a brother-in-law or, you know, a family member that starts listening to podcasts recently, tell them about Jim, Brian, and Brad, and say, hey, you know, these guys usually cover some pretty neat stuff every week, and then the other half of the time, they ramble on about stuff that they're interested in. So tell somebody about us. Let's get our ideas spread across the South and even further.
Very shortly, if you guys have Stitcher or TuneIn in your car, I know some services, some car makers offer that, you'll be able to listen to us through that as well without even needing a phone. Keep in mind that's about to happen very shortly. Until next time, later, fellas.
Later on.
Later, fellas.
Please visit infiniteloopback.com for show notes and previous episodes. You can find us on Twitter. The Twitter handle for the show is @infinloopback. That's @infinloopback. I am @BrianB. That's @BrianB. Jim is @BigJim. That's @BigJim. And Brad is @MeesterIdle. That's @MeesterIdle. Thanks for listening, and we hope to talk to you next time.